Good evening, and welcome once again to Your Legal Rights on KALW 91.7 FM, San Francisco Bay Area. I'm the host of Your Legal Rights, Jeff Hayden. I'm joined in the studio by tonight's co-host, retired San Francisco attorney David Bigelizen. David.
Tonight on Your Legal Rights, we're starting to talk about our immigration system. We're looking at the issues of humanity and immigration, and we're looking at the immigration system as it is right now, which is a system of control. Jeffrey.
Last year, we asked, what is it going to take before Congress will take up fair and just immigration reform? Haven't we clearly lost ground? Do non-citizens somehow make up a larger percentage of the population than they did in years past? Do undocumented immigrants make up a larger percentage of the overall population than in years past?
Last year you asked, when someone shows up at the border claiming asylum, does the system give him or her the benefit of the doubt? Do they have a fair chance? If not, why not? What's it like this year? And Jeffrey, isn't the fight for immigrant and refugee rights a forgotten right or as part of our fight for racial justice?
Obviously, folks, there's much to discuss. As always, you can call regarding any question on tonight's topic. We're talking immigration. We're talking immigration law. We are talking about the assault on non-citizens. You're not limited to the exact point we may be in our conversation. Our phone number right here is 415-841-4134. Again, that's 415-841-4134. If you're outside of the San Francisco Bay Area, call us toll-free at 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-8255. Whichever phone you use, we'd like you, as our most important guest, to come join us in the conversation. But bear in mind that our attorney guests cannot provide you precise legal advice. They don't have all the facts relating to your case. We're happy to pass along legal principles to assist you in your decision-making. Their legal guidance mightn't be the positions of their employers or clients, but folks, they're here to help. That's why we're here. Joining us tonight, Professor Bill Hing. Bill Hing founded the Immigrant Legal Resource Center in 1979 and served as volunteer executive director for its first two decades. A professor at the University of San Francisco School of Law, Professor Hing is the author of at least 14 books, including, most recently, Humanizing Immigration, How to Transform Our Racist and Unjust System. An expert in immigration policy, negotiations, public service strategies, Asian American legal history, Bill Hing is a professor at the University of San Francisco, where he serves as professor of law. I could go on, but without further ado, Dr. Bill Hing, welcome back to Your Legal Rights.
Thank you for the invitation. I was going to say I'm happy to be here. I'm pleased to be in your company.
Thank you. I wish the circumstances were a little better. Last year I asked you, what is it going to take before Congress will take up fair and just immigration reform? Is there anything looming that looks anything like reform?
Well, to most of the public, I think the answer would be a clear no, but, and I may be, I'm not making this up, there is one possible thing that is going through the mind of our current president, and that relates to Dreamers. And Dreamers, as your audience probably may know, are those folks that came as small children to the United States and were brought by their parents either without inspection or overstayed their visas. And they grew up here, went to high school here. Many have gone to college here. But they don't have immigration status. And there's probably a couple million Dreamers in the United States. President Obama granted deferred action to childhood arrivals to this group, and so a subset of Dreamers received what is called DACA. The reason I'm pointing that out is that President Trump has the authority to terminate DACA, and I can explain why in a minute if you're interested. He has the authority to terminate DACA, but he has not done that. And There is a school of thought that he is open to negotiation to pass the DREAM Act, but for something in exchange. That is the million-dollar question. What would he ask for in exchange? So I think there is a reason why he hasn't terminated DACA. I do think that there may be some conversations that the administration is having with, at least within the Republican Party, about what could be sought in exchange for passing the DREAM Act, which would grant legalization to those folks that grew up here undocumented.
So, Bill, does that mean that for the time being, the Dreamers can continue to stay?
That means that for the time being, DACA recipients, and we're down to about 500,000 right now. When Trump was first elected 8 years ago, or I'm losing track, I guess 5 years ago, there was something like 700,000, 800,000 back in 2016. We're down to about 500, and I can explain why, because some have left, some have gotten a green card. They are safe. They can continue to get extensions 2 years at a time of their work permits, and they're promised not to be deported. So I check every day to make sure that that's still true, and every day they're approving extensions of those DACA recipients. So yeah, at least that 500,000, they're safe.
You know, you brought up something interesting, which struck me with a very similar situation as some years back. You mentioned people that were brought over here when they were very, very young. I had a client who was brought over here as an infant, did not know he was not born here until he was invited in for an interview. His first question was, who are we talking about? And that's when the handcuffs came out. Is there any relief for someone like that?
Well, there are many DACA recipients, Dreamers, who have had the same story. They didn't know that they were not born here. And so it depends, and this is where we're getting a little bit technical. It depends, for example, if they entered with inspection or without inspection. And what I mean by that, without inspection, folks can probably imagine their parents brought them across the border surreptitiously. With inspection are people who came, for example, with their parents who had visitor's visas or student visas, and then they overstayed those visas. So those are the two general categories. If they entered with inspection, and for example, if that person married a U.S. citizen, then they could regularize their status pretty easily. But if they entered without inspection, and having the same hypothetical, they married a U.S. citizen, but they entered without inspection, they cannot adjust their status in the United States. They have to depart the United States, and then they're usually subject to something called a 10-year bar. For anyone who's lived here without documents for more than a year, they're subject to a 10-year bar. So the answer to your question is it depends often on how they entered. The other answer to your question is if they've lived here for more than 10 years undocumented and they're arrested and put in removal proceedings, they can apply for a relief called cancellation of removal, but it's very difficult to obtain cancellation of removal. You have to demonstrate very, very high levels of hardships on your citizen children or a spouse who might be a citizen. And so it's a very difficult road to hoe if you're undocumented, even if you have citizen children.
Wow. Well, should we then move to another subject? How about if we talk about the Alien Enemies Act? Would you like to talk with us about that?
One of the big topics of the day, as your listeners may recall, we first heard about the Alien Enemies Act, I'm losing track of time, but a few weeks after the inauguration, it could have been a few days after the inauguration. Listeners may recall that the Trump administration flew off to El Salvador a plane load of men who were mostly from Venezuela, over 200 were from Venezuela, to El Salvador under the pretext that these folks who were not criminals, but they were alleged gang members of so-called gang called Tren de Aragua. And everybody, we all scratch our head. Immigrant rights advocates scratch our head. What is he talking about? He invoked something called the Alien Enemies Act, which is from the 1800s, where Congress passed a law that, in fact, the executive has the power to deport and exclude people who are nationals of a country that we are at war at. There's two provisions in the Alien Enemies Act. Are we at war with that country, or have they invaded our country? So those are the two conditions that the Alien Enemies Act can be invoked. So we're wondering, wait a minute, we're not at war. We haven't declared war with Venezuela. And as far as we know, Venezuela is not invading us. Well, they are arguing, the Trump administration is arguing, oh, in fact, they are invading us. President Maduro of Venezuela has dispatched this gang to invade the United States. And that's the basis for which they invoked the Alien Enemies Act. Of course, that's tied up in court. The invocation of the Alien Enemies Act has been challenged. That issue has gone up to the Supreme Court once already. And the issue was, could the Trump administration deport people under the Alien Enemies Act? The Supreme Court, without due process, mm-hmm. because these folks were put on an airplane, no hearings. The Supreme Court ruled on the due process issue. They didn't rule on the Alien Enemies Act issue. They ruled 9-0. 9-0, even Clarence Thomas and Sam Alito went along with this the first time around, that you cannot deport these folks without some semblance of due process. But the only due process they came up with at that stage was you have to at least afford them the right to file for habeas corpus. And so for the listeners in the audience who aren't attorneys, habeas corpus is you go into federal court arguing that you should not be in detention because your detention is in violation of a constitutional right. And so that's one thing. The nine justices said, you got to give them habeas corpus. The other thing they said is, you can only do this habeas corpus proceeding in the district where the person was detained. And those 200 souls were detained initially in Texas. So that's where we ended up. But to close that loop, the Supreme Court said, we're not deciding yet whether or not the Alien Enemies Act is proper. What we are deciding is that you got to give them due process and habeas corpus. There have now been four district courts, judges, that have held substantively the Alien Enemies Act is not proper. There's no invasion. There's no declared war. One Trump appointee, a fifth district court judge in a different district, has said, yes, the Alien Enemy Act applies, but you at least still have to give them due process, habeas corpus. So that's where we are on the Alien Enemies Act.
Does that mean that the government is obligated to bring these 200-some-odd people back from a prison in El Salvador and afford them hearings in the United States?
I believe that that's ultimately what the litigators, and this is being led by ACLU, I believe that that's what the litigators are ultimately seeking, is bring them back. And the issue has come up on an individual case. This gentleman, Abrego Garcia, mm-hmm. who was also sent to El Salvador, he happens to be one individual who was from El Salvador. Most of these folks were from Venezuela. And this is a gentleman that it's particularly upsetting. It should be upsetting to us because before he was put on that airplane a few years ago, he had a deportation hearing. And an immigration judge granted him something that's similar to asylum. He granted him something called withholding of removal, that he could not be removed to El Salvador because he demonstrated that he was going to be persecuted in El Salvador. But they put this guy, and he was sent to El Salvador. And there was concern that he might even be, whether or not he would still be safe. And as listeners probably remember, the senator from where he lived, Senator Van Hollen, actually went to visit him. And fortunately, he's still alive. So what the judge in that individual case has ordered that he be brought back, and he wants to know what efforts, have reasonable efforts been made to bring him back. And the judge allowed discovery to take place, and I think that discovery period is ending this week. And so I think we're about to hear what reasonable efforts have been made to facilitate the issue of bringing him back. And there's a debate over what it means to facilitate his return.
Well, you know, there's another dimension to this that I'm quite troubled about, and that is the 200 people that were bundled off on the airplane, the Venezuelan men, and Mr. Abrego Garcia, were sent to prison. Now, don't we have a law that says that you're presumed innocent until you're proven guilty? Don't you have the right to a trial by jury? Don't you have the right to a lawyer? Don't you have a right to the notice of the charges against you and the right to bring witnesses in your own behavior, in your own behalf, before they throw you in prison? What's going on here?
And one of the remedies we might have would be a writ of habeas corpus. And we got a lesson from the Secretary of Homeland Security just this week about what habeas corpus was, according to her.
Yeah, habeas corpus, according to the Secretary of Homeland Security, it's just a piece of paper, and it's pretty meaningless. But she's wrong. The habeas corpus is one of the most fundamental rights in the Constitution, to be honest with you. But back to your question, David. Your question is about due process. And unfortunately, those of us who are immigration lawyers know that due process is not the same as the due process rights that somebody facing criminal charges faces. These folks that were sent to El Salvador were not facing criminal charges. They were removed. Okay, so that's deportation. However, you do have rights if you're going to be deported. You're right. You have a right to an attorney, not at government expense, but you do have a right. You have a right to a hearing before an impartial judge, and that's what habeas corpus provides. So that was violated. And so absolutely, their due process rights, even immigration due process rights, were violated, and that's why ultimately the relief is bringing these folks back to determine, were they in fact being sent away properly under the Alien Enemies Act, and were they afforded due process? Were they in fact invaders? Were they in fact members of a gang? Because that's a whole other issue. There's strong evidence that none of these individuals were members of the gang. They based that, the government based that conclusion on things like their social media, but on tattoos. They classified Michael Jordan tattoos as evidence that they were members of this gang, and that's just incredible.
But, you know, we also, it's not just removal, which for people in previous parlance would be, that's just deportation. Above and beyond that, these folks were not only removed from the United States, they were not returned to their home country. They were removed to a third country with all but Mr. Abrego Garcia. All the others were returned to a third country, which we had under contract. And we are paying this country to imprison these people at our expense. Do we normally treat people that are being removed by sending them to third country prisons when the only crime that they've been accused of is being here?
During the height of the Afghan and Iraq war, we call that extraterritorial rendition. Well, there's just so much to say in response to your question. One, they were not given a deportation hearing, okay? And so their fundamental rights to due process were abused in that sense. Two, the judge has ordered that there be a review of how these guys were even put on the airplane. The original judge, Boasberg, is very upset who had this case. And minute by minute, he showed that the airplanes actually were not, had not left the ground when he made his oral decision that they should not be removed. So he's very upset about that. And I think that there's, we're going to be some orders of contempt that are going to be in place in several of these cases soon. And we should talk about that if we have time during this hour, because what will the Trump administration do if there's orders of contempt? However, back to your point, there's two different groups. There's two different groups of people that have been sent or have been attempted to be sent to countries from which they've never been to. One group is the group that we're talking about now. It's very clear that that's an abuse of any type of authority that the executive has. There's a second group, however, that 2 weeks ago the government tried to deport to Libya, and then a subset of them tried to deport and, in fact, put six of them on an airplane to South Sudan. That group is different from the El Salvador group. The second group are people that have lived here lawfully for many years, green card holders, but they committed crimes, serious crimes, as lawful permanent residents. So that group of individuals, and it was less than 20, they committed aggravated felonies. They were never deported, even though they were ordered deported by immigration judges, because their countries wouldn't take them back. So that's a wholly different group. The government in that case is arguing, well, we found some country that will take them. We found South Sudan, we found South Africa, we found Libya, and so we can send them wherever they want to. But that is wrong. It's true that if they find another country that they might be able to send those folks to those other countries. But again, under the immigration laws, they're supposed to be given a chance, notice of the impending deportation, and an opportunity to argue why they shouldn't be deported to the third country. So there's two different attempts going on and two different answers to that question.
Well, can we change the subject a little bit and talk a little bit about birthright citizenship?
Absolutely. I'm a product of birthright citizenship. And for the audience, I should know the answer to this, but I don't. There's millions and millions of people in the United States who have benefited from birthright citizenship. And I want you to think about this, those of you in the audience. If one or more of your parents was not a citizen when you were born, if they were an immigrant, then you benefited from birthright citizenship. In other words, if you're born in the United States and one or both of your parents was not born here, not a natural-born citizen, well, you benefited from birthright citizenship. And under the 14th Amendment, the 14th Amendment says that anyone who was born here under the jurisdiction of the United States is automatically a U.S. citizen. And that provision of the 14th Amendment was passed by Congress after the end of the Civil War to make sure that black slaves who were born here were U.S. citizens. That came up in 1898. It was a case that came out of San Francisco. It's a case called Wong Kim Ark. And it was a gentleman that was born, I think, on Sacramento Street or Jackson Street in Chinatown. And he left the country a couple times, one time to go visit his parents who had gone back to China after they were immigrants here. And the second time around, the immigration inspector said, well, your parents weren't citizens when you were born, so you're not a citizen. And he said, but I was born in San Francisco. And they said, well, that doesn't make a difference. Long story short, his case ends up at the Supreme Court in 1898. And the Supreme Court just read the 14th Amendment and said, he's a citizen. And so that's been the law. President Trump on either day one or two of his administration issued an executive order saying that if at least one of your parents was not a citizen, then you're not a citizen if you're born here. If one of your parents was a citizen, fine. But if both of them were green card holders or foreign students or, God forbid, undocumented, then you're not a citizen. And so there have been by last count, at least six cases filed. Every lower court has essentially thrown the Trump administration lawyers out of the courtroom. In Seattle, the federal district court judge in Seattle was very, very insulting to the Trump administration attorneys, saying, basically, get out of my courtroom. How can you make these arguments with a straight face that the 14th Amendment doesn't apply here? Jurisdiction is jurisdiction. So some listeners may be confused because 2 weeks ago, the Supreme Court heard a peripheral issue on this case. And the issue was, could one federal judge issue a nationwide injunction stopping the implementation of the executive order? So it was a federal civil procedure case. And the Supreme Court is going to rule whether or not a federal district court judge can issue a nationwide injunction. That's what that case was about. Now, the issue of whether or not the substantive issue is the executive order valid or not, it might creep in, but that's not the issue before the court at this point.
Well, Bill, does that mean that when it comes to birthright citizenship, that if the issue of birthright citizenship comes up in a district other than the five districts where it's been heard, that they have to start out all over again?
If the Supreme Court rules that a federal district court judge does not have the power to issue a universal preliminary injunction, then that's absolutely right. And they might do that. The Supreme Court might say that a federal judge can't issue these nationwide injunctions anymore. And if that happens, you're right. I fear, for example, somebody born in Texas, that where many of the judges there are quite conservative, and they could uphold the birthright citizenship executive order until this gets to the Supreme Court.
I did get one interesting question. You mentioned other states and how people are looking at things. And in California, let's be really clear about one thing. We have better resources here than probably just about any place in the country. I did get a text while we're on air from an attorney in Nevada who asks, how can she put into action in Nevada what is going on in California? In Nevada, the jail holds inmates indefinitely on ice holds, even when they've posted bonds. Is there anything that you recommend where she might go to take action there?
She has to file a habeas corpus action on behalf of one of those individuals, arguing that that the individuals have a right to bond, okay, to post bond. And here's a complication, however. There is an administrative decision under the Trump administration that holds that somebody who just recently came in, who is caught, can be held without bond. And that has to be challenged in court. So that's her first challenge, is that if this person came in within the last couple of years, they may try to invoke that administrative decision. So she needs to challenge that administrative decision by going into federal district court on a habeas corpus motion. But you're absolutely right. She's absolutely right. The standard rule of whether or not you should be held by ICE is two questions. Are you a danger to the community, or are you likely to abscond? And if you can show the person's not dangerous, and if you can show the person's in a stable living condition, then they should be afforded bond.
Before we break for station ID, I did want to take a brief moment of personal privilege and give a shout out to our frequent co-host, guest, expert on anything whatsoever that comes up with regard to elections, and that would be Brent Turner, who on Sunday was awarded by San Mateo County in an official proclamation. Every May 25th, starting Sunday last, is now known in San Mateo County as Brent Turner Here. Congratulations to our friend and sometimes co-host. You're listening to Your Legal Rights on KALW 91.7 FM. We'll be back right after this.
Support for KALW is provided by the Bar Association of San Francisco. If you live in San Francisco or Marin County, the Bar Association's lawyer referral service can arrange for you to meet with an attorney experienced in the area of law related to your situation. Call 415-989-1616 or visit sfbar.org for more information.
You're listening to Your Legal Rights on KALW 91.7 FM. San Francisco Bay Area. I'm Jeff Hayden. Tonight, we're discussing immigration law, current events, current policy, with tonight's guest, professor, author, activist, Bill Hing from USF, and tonight's co-host, David Begeleisen. If you have questions for my guests, our phone number is 415-841-4134. Again, that's 415-841-4134. If you're outside of the San Francisco Bay Area, call us toll-free at 866-798-8255. Again, that's 866-798-8255. You can call regarding any question. You want to talk about current events, current administration policy. You want to get right to the core and talk about immigration law. You're not limited to the exact point where we may be in our conversation. And before we resume, let me take a call from Ramon in San Ramon.
Thank you. I would just like to make two quick comments that anyone who is here in the country without permission or harbors somebody that is here illegally is in violation of Title 8 U.S. United States Code 1324, and anybody that seeks asylum does so through a legal port of entry, not through the desert and a hole in the border wall in the cover of night. That's not seeking asylum.
Bill, I'm glad that this gentleman brought that up, because that's what I was about to lead into, was the asylum law and its application. Why not begin by describing the international law of asylum, and then talk about what we're dealing with now?
Sure. We are signatories to something called a 1969 Protocol on Refugees. So we're bound, the United States, by we, I mean the United States is bound by international standards of non-refoulement, which we agreed to not send somebody back who is in fear of being persecuted in their home country. And that's irrespective, and this is relevant to what the caller just said, that's irrespective of how you got here. If you make your way, I know it's difficult for people, but try to put yourself in the shoes of somebody who's fleeing violence. Yeah, I mean, maybe some of us might want an orderly line at the port of entry, but other people may not be in that position to be able to do that. Anyway, we're bound. And the way that gets manifested in the law is under the 1980 Refugee Act. And so there's two ways that somebody can become, quote unquote, a refugee. One way is by applying abroad. So the President of the United States has the authority every year to designate what parts of the world from which refugees can arrive. That's after 1980. And so every president, except for President Trump, has been relatively generous. That's how most Southeast Asian refugees came to the United States under Ronald Reagan and the first George Bush. They came in under refugee provisions to allow them in. The other way of becoming a refugee is by applying for asylum. And what I was going to say is, for refugees, it was very common, 100,000 per year, sometimes more than that. President Trump basically has closed the door. Even in his first iteration, the most he ever allowed in was a few thousand each year. The other way of becoming a refugee is by applying for asylum after you get here. Flying in here, coming at the border, showing up at the border. I mean, your caller is right, is that everybody that we work with, my clinic and I work with at the southern border, And we're led by my partner in crime at the University of San Francisco, Professor Jacqueline Brown, who's at the forefront of asylum rights in the country. When we go to the border, we meet people who want to wait patiently to come in to apply, but the Trump administration has closed the door to that. But once you get here and you apply for asylum, you have to show a well-founded fear of persecution under international law and under U.S. law. Well-founded fear of persecution on one of five grounds: political opinion, membership in a particular social group, race, religion, or nationality. And so you've got to make a case. And I was privileged to win a big case in this area back in the 1980s, INS versus Cardoso Fonseca, where the Supreme Court held in a 6-3 decision that the standard, this is important, the standard of proof for asylum is below 50%. In fact, the Supreme Court said if you have a 1 in 10 chance of being persecuted, you should be granted asylum. Why so generous? Because this is a humanitarian statute. It's intended to give the benefit of the doubt to asylum seekers. I think immigration judges often forget this, but asylum is meant to be humanitarian. We want to give the benefit of the doubt. Why? Because we would rather allow someone to stay in the country who won't be persecuted. We'd rather do that than to send somebody back home who will be persecuted. That's the mistake we'd rather make, is give the benefit of the doubt to the asylum seeker.
Let me take another call from Mark in San Leandro. Mark, you're on the air. Welcome to Your Legal Rights.
Yeah, thank you. A great program. I'm a senior citizen. I came here when I was a little kid. I'm Canadian, and I've had my green card renewed twice, no problem. And now I understand that, I was guilty of a misdemeanor about 40 years ago. And since then, I've had a clean record. Is there an issue there with my card? I have to go down to Mexico, see a family member who's feeling poorly.
That's a really good question. There is an issue, okay? First of all, you should find out exactly what, you go to a specialist to find out what you mean by misdemeanor. But I'm assuming, hypothetically, I don't want to ask you, okay? Hypothetically, let's say it was a petty theft. Well,
yeah.
Believe it or not, if you get a second petty theft, even though it's decades apart, that makes you deportable. And so you got to make sure that you only have one conviction. And Duke University just issued recommendations to all its employees and students, even those who have green cards, do not leave the country. Even those with green cards, they're afraid that something might happen at the border, and there may be something in your social media or something in your background that triggers a problem. And so I know I sound hysterical, and I don't mean to, because I don't want to foment fear, but I think you should check before you leave the country.
Check with whom?
An immigration lawyer.
Bill, in that respect, the government renders people deportable and excludable if they've been found guilty of what's called an aggravated felony. Sometimes people think that if they have a misdemeanor conviction, it's not a felony and therefore they're home free. Mm-hmm. Is that right?
Well, okay. So aggravated felony is a class in and of itself, okay?
Interrupting you. This was a simple shoplifting less than $300.
Right. Let me be really clear on something for people listening. I want to make sure nobody interprets or misinterprets what Professor Hing said. Nobody is saying you're safe with the first one, therefore just don't do it again and have a first one. Things are moving very, very quickly right now. And for somebody who's here and undocumented, if I understand the situation correctly, they can be under brand new law, they can be detained for a simple shoplift if they're here without documents. It's not a good time.
They will be detained. They will be detained. Let me finish answering David's point on aggravated felonies. There are some crimes that are aggravated felonies that would shock the heck out of you, okay, that are classified that way. You're right. In some states, something labeled a misdemeanor might actually, for immigration purposes, be classified an aggravated felony. However, the other problem with being classified as an aggravated felony is that once it's an aggravated felony, you don't really have a relief from removal. You cannot apply for asylum, for example. The only thing you can apply for is something that is very difficult to achieve, and it's protection under the Convention Against Torture if you have an aggravated felony. However, David, if you have two misdemeanors that are not aggravated felonies, you can still be deportable for two misdemeanors that are not classified an aggravated felony. But then you can apply for a waiver. Okay, an aggravated felon cannot apply for a waiver, but somebody with two misdemeanors can apply for a waiver.
Sounds like there's some fine points here, Bill.
Some very fine points, and I'm also talking about people with lawful permanent residence. Somebody who's undocumented, who as Jeff just said, someone who's undocumented who has a minor crime, they're going to be detained and they're going to be deported.
Well, let's talk about some misdemeanors that we now consider to be fairly petty. And by that, I mean minor drug offenses. And then other offenses that are misdemeanors that are serious, but they are misdemeanors, such as wife beating and things like that. Mm-hmm. Those are aggravated felonies, are they not?
Absolutely. Spousal abuse can definitely be. And I know that you've had experts on the show before, Francisco Ugarte and those who are specialized in criminal immigration issues. It's a science. The immigration lawyers are now called upon, and public defenders are now called upon, to do adequate advice to somebody who is facing a criminal charge, and that's based on a Supreme Court case, Padilla versus Kentucky, that was decided back in 2010, I believe. And so criminal defense attorneys have an extra responsibility. And also immigration lawyers, after the fact, if somebody comes in with a crime, there is something called post-conviction relief that so-called criminal immigration experts might be able to help clear things up to make sure someone is no longer deportable. But, David, your point is very well taken. Anyone who's not a citizen with any sort of criminal record, they should actually check with an expert to determine whether or not they are removable or if they're inadmissible if they ever want to apply for a permanent residence.
You know, I did get a skeptical text from a listener, Mark, while you're still on the phone, questioning, as a practical matter, what are the chances that the Trump administration is going after a Canadian expatriate with a misdemeanor? Isn't the administration more focused on targeting immigrants of color?
I definitely agree that there's racial profiling going on. On the other hand, I do know that the Trump administration is hanging around courthouses too, state courthouses, and they're keeping a look at records. You're right. Some ICE agents probably are looking at Spanish surnames or some other surname, and they may not be looking for somebody whose last name is Smith or Jones or Howard. So your point is well taken.
In my case, I have a green card, and I've had no problem renewing to get a green card, and I know that there's one misdemeanor on my record.
That's right.
Great.
Don't give him advice.
Yeah, good luck to you.
Yeah, well, I know you can't give advice, but thanks again.
No, there are things that you can do, and you can get expert advice from a number of places in the region. The Alameda County Bar Association should have somebody that can assist you. Their number is 510-302-2222. Alternatively, the Bar Association of San Francisco has a lawyer referral and information service at 415-989-1616. both of these organizations tend to have clinics from time to time where people can help you. And there may be a basis to go back and look at your conviction, because under current law in California, the mere fact that you did not understand the potential immigration consequences of your conviction, even though this was not federal law at the time, if you didn't understand what it might mean later, that in and of itself may be a basis to go back after all these decades and vacate your conviction. So I think the best advice you got tonight was to have somebody as an expert look at it and talk to them about that.
Okay. You do a great job. Thanks so much.
Thank you for joining us.
So let's talk about arresting people at the courthouse.
Well, there's two courthouses involved. Let's first talk about state courthouses. ICE is camping out at outside, not inside, different courthouses. Judges don't want ICE inside their courtrooms. And listeners may recall that, again, 3 or 4 weeks ago, a Wisconsin state court judge was arrested for aiding, abetting, or harboring some allegation of that nature, because there's an allegation that she showed the back door to somebody who ICE was looking for. In California, ICE is keeping track of the court calendar, and they often have information that somebody is non-citizen who's facing criminal charges. I've heard some allegations also that they're aware of people who are showing up to be witnesses or maybe victims of crime, and which is just so unfair in terms of seeking justice, because we need witnesses, we need victims to step forward. And if they're not doing that, then all of us get hurt, you know, because justice isn't being rendered in the way that that we all deserve. And so that is happening. It's very controversial. That's happening across the country, where ICE is making arrests at courthouses. ICE is, this may sound not that big of a deal to people, but ICE is also arresting people at federal immigration courthouses. Just in the last couple of weeks, ICE has been showing up at the immigration courts locally, San Francisco, Concord, Sacramento, and if cases are being dismissed, or if relatives are in the building that might be undocumented, they will ask for documentation. And they have just today, yesterday they arrested 4 people and. In the San Francisco Immigration Court, and they made a couple of arrests in San Diego yesterday, I understand. And so yeah, they're arresting people at immigration courthouses as well. And to Jeff's point, the arrests are manifested by not just handcuffs, but being put in detention. And they're going to argue that these folks should not be given bond if the right to post bail.
Well, it sounds to me as though they were coming to court in order to observe the system. And what happens is that the whole thing ends up backwards. And instead of observing the system and getting a decision as to whether they're entitled to relief or not, they end up getting locked up.
That's what could be happening, because the ICE is asking the ICE attorneys are asking the immigration judge to dismiss the case. ICE is making a motion to dismiss without prejudice, incidentally. And then once the judge dismisses, then the judge doesn't have jurisdiction over that person, and ICE has the freedom to take the person into custody. Whereas if the immigration judge kept jurisdiction, then the person's asylum application or whatever would still be with the immigration judge, and it would be less likely that person would be taken into detention.
It sounds like a cruel trap to me.
It is a trap. The people are walking in. Here's the other thing that's happening. Folks are hearing about this happening. And as many resources as there are in the Bay Area, most people go into immigration court unrepresented. And so they hear about ICE arresting people. And so We're worried, immigrant rights advocates are worried, that these folks are not going to show up at their hearing. Once they don't show up at their hearing, the immigration judge will order the person deported on the grounds that they didn't show up at their hearing. Immigration judge has the authority to order someone deportable in absentia. And so it's a trap. And we are trying to encourage people to show up. And we have volunteer attorneys. The Bar Association of San Francisco has, and the local Immigrant Rights Coalition, Immigrant Legal Defense Coalition, has offered to have regular people, at least in the San Francisco court, available to advise people during these times.
Well, you know, is there some place that people can go universally? Because what you're describing is not limited to immigration court. It's happening in state courts. It's happening in schools. It's happening in hospitals. It's happening in a number of different places, which each for its own policy reasons used to be thought of as off limits.
Under the Trump, under the Obama administration, there was a memo issued for guidance to ICE officers. It was called the Sensitive Locations Memo. And that Sensitive Locations Memo pretty much restrained ICE agents from doing enforcement work at churches, schools, and hospitals. The Trump administration, number one, did not cancel that memo. So that was interesting, although there were some incidents of enforcement at hospitals under Trump 1. The Biden administration expanded the memo to include such things as don't go to parks where there are children and families, don't go to birthday parties and that type of thing. On day two of the Trump administration, the Sensitive Locations memo was canceled. And so ICE agents got the message that they could go after folks at churches, hospitals, and schools. That is happening in certain parts of the country. The Bay Area, as far as I know, there haven't been enforcement, ICE enforcement operations at churches, schools, and hospitals. There have been some at workplaces, some at apartment buildings, but in the Bay Area, that's been targeted. It's people, individuals that are on a list. So there's not widespread raids that have happened. There was one in Kern County, Bakersfield, early on, but not in the Bay Area so far.
I have heard of ICE agents showing up at public schools to perform welfare checks on immigrant children or perhaps children of immigrants.
Welfare checks also of at home. So unaccompanied, many people who came to the border, and in fact, that's why we started the clinic at the University of San Francisco in 2014, 2015, was because of the surge of unaccompanied minors. Many unaccompanied minors come to the border, and by unaccompanied, it's a little bit of a misdemeanor, misnomer. If you came with your aunt, uncle, grandparent, or older sibling, you're still considered an unaccompanied minor. If you come with your parent, you're not an unaccompanied minor. The reason I'm pointing this out is that an unaccompanied minor can get different relief, different from asylum. And an unaccompanied minor, and in fact, even some that are not unaccompanied, but minors, can get something called special immigrant juvenile status. It's a separate relief. And in order to get special immigrant juvenile status, many of those who apply go through a guardianship procedure through the probate court. Many of them also were in detention under the Office of Refugee Resettlement. In both those incidents, either if you were in the Office of Refugee Resettlement or if you're getting guardianship through a probate court in San Francisco, you have to have a guardian and a designated guardian. In those circumstances, especially those that were in ORR, Office of Refugee Resettlement, ICE feels that they can do a welfare check to make sure that you are not released to, for example, to a trafficker or somebody who's abusing you. So that's the pretext that ICE is using to do these welfare checks. They're saying they're checking on who is the guardian for these children to make sure that they are not in the hands of traffickers or an abuser.
Bill, We're going to be coming back in 2 weeks to talk about a lot more about this. But why don't we pause right now and spend a few minutes talking with our listener audience about where they can get help and more information about their immigration problems.
So, yes, every bar association in different counties has a lawyer's referral sheet, and they all have a list of immigration specialists, and they're usually vetted in some way, and so that's one place to start. In San Francisco, the Bar Association of San Francisco also has a Justice and Diversity Center that keeps a list of nonprofit organizations. There are excellent nonprofit organizations that specialize in counseling individuals. There's far too many for me to mention here, but you can find that list. You can look, for example, for the San Francisco Immigrant Legal Defense Collaborative, SFILDC, and there's a long list of reliable community-based organizations that includes the University of San Francisco Immigration and Deportation Defense Clinic. But that's where to start, is with local bar associations and with nonprofit organizations that specialize in immigration services.
Let's give the phone number for the Bar Association of San Francisco Lawyer Referral Service once again. Jeffrey.
That number is 415-989-1616.
Repeat it.
415-989-1616.
Okay, good.
And as David alluded to, we have a lot more material to go into that we haven't barely scratched the surface. Right up until today, when Secretary of State Marco Rubio announced that they would be wholesale revoking student visas from Chinese immigrant students. So there's a lot to go in, and frankly, this whole field is changing almost by the minute. So we're back here in 2 weeks with Professor Bill Hing. David, you'll be joining us back?
Absolutely. It's an honor to be here.
You've been listening to Your Legal Rights on KALW 91.7 FM, San Francisco Bay Area. Tonight we've been discussing immigration. There's no justice. It's just ICE. We've been talking current events. And as I said, we've just scratched the surface, so we resume in 2 weeks with tonight's guest, Professor Bill Hing from the University of San Francisco School of Law, and again with my co-host, David Bigalizen. Tonight's show was produced by David Bigalizen and yours truly. A big thanks to the next guest, Professor Activist Bill Hing. Please come join us again. On behalf of Your Legal Rights, a big thanks to all of you for listening. And at the controls, Joanne Marr, and for tonight's co-host David Bigalizen. I'm Jeff Hayden. Be safe, have a great night, and zealously guard your legal rights.
Support for KALW is provided by the Bar Association of San Francisco. If you live in San Francisco or Marin County, the Bar Association's Lawyer Referral Service can arrange for you to meet with an attorney experienced in the area of law related to your situation. Call 415-989-1616 or visit sfbar.org for more information.